This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 5th, 2017.
The horrific events of yesterday demonstrate that, unfortunately, war crimes are going on in Syria.
This attack bears all the hallmarks of chemical weapons against its own people.
Yet another reminder, if we needed any, of the need for us to come together and put an end to this war.
We need a political solution to the conflict.
Chemical weapons as the worst of the war crimes, and whoever is responsible for that must be held accountable.
I don't think, again, we need to look at options at this point. I'm not going to get ahead of the president and the team. I think right now our concern is for the people of Syria and the victims of this attack. We have plenty of time to chart a way forward.
A suspected chemical attack in the northern rebel-held territory of Idlib, Syria, begins our coverage, killing scores of people. It's a brutal backdrop to a conference on international aid to Syria underway in Brussels today, Supporting the Future of Syria and the Region. It's the confusing title of the conference, which could easily be shorthand for the major challenge of this century: persistent regional wars, massive refugee disruptions across the globe, and trying to find a way to return war-torn nations to normalcy. Does President Trump have a stake in this conflict? Earlier this week, the White House said the ousting of Bashar al-Assad is not the focus of American efforts in Syria. The White House also condemned yesterday's chemical attack and pointed to former President Obama's fuzzy red lines when Syria used chemical weapons back in 2013. Robert Ford was U.S. ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He says there's no model in history for rebuilding a country without ending its civil war.
In order for reconstruction to begin, you have to have security. And with the exception of the inner city of Damascus, for example, most parts of the country still do not have security in the way we would understand it, so that you could have people come in and rebuild safely and bring materials in without having them stolen, hijacked. So there isn't going to be any reconstruction in the immediate future. There's still too much fighting going on.
There's really no precedent for this kind of nation building in the midst of war. I mean, yes, you're right. There's going to have to be some time taken here, but there's also going to have to be some authority that takes, for example, the security of Idlib, where the chemical attack took place this week. Who would be responsible for making sure that Idlib is secure so that reconstruction can begin there, let alone the downtown of Damascus?
Well, for example, the United States tried to rebuild Iraq starting in 2004 and 2005 and 2006 with tens of billions of American dollars. And the effort was largely unsuccessful because there wasn't security. A team from the World Bank in Washington has drawn up some initial estimates, back of the envelope estimates, that conclude that it'll take over $300 billion to rebuild Syria. And I think Assad understands he's not going to get anywhere near $300 billion. There's simply no source of financing that's going to come forward with that kind of money. And I frankly don't think he cares all that much about the reconstruction of some of the cities in the periphery. He's a man who repeatedly uses chemical weapons against civilians, is not particularly concerned about their economic welfare and whether their health clinics are rebuilt or their schools are reopened, et cetera, clean water, et cetera. I think he will be interested perhaps in rebuilding some of the inner cities of eastern Syria, which are in a sense his political base, his political stronghold along the Mediterranean coast. And the rest of the country, frankly, he doesn't care that much about. He doesn't control it anyway, and he's not likely to control it anytime soon.
Do you find it striking that here we are, this terrible, brutal, horrible war in Syria, and the responsibility somewhere in the region is to rebuild and to figure out what the future will be if this war ever ends? But the U.S. wasn't really involved in the discussions that took place in Turkey. There's no real leadership role for the U.S. in this Brussels conference. Does that represent a significant change? And we also don't know really the position of the Trump administration regarding Syria.
Well, I think we do know the position of the Trump administration regarding Syria, which is they don't care about the larger civil war between Assad and different opposition elements. They don't care about that. They do care about fighting one particular part of the civil war, which is the Islamic State part, but they don't connect that to the larger civil war. And of course, if you don't want to fight forever in Syria, if you don't want to, then you have to address the recruitment problem to extremist groups like the Islamic State. How do you undercut the recruitment? And I don't think there's any serious analyst who believes you can undercut the recruitment, stop the recruitment without addressing that broader civil war that involves Assad. And the American government has not played a serious role in that for months now. John Kerry tried last year up until the middle of the year. And now the Russians and the Iranians are driving this forward with occasional support from Turkey. But the Americans are playing no role, not in the ceasefire talks in Kazakhstan, fumblings, failing ceasefire talks, not in the United Nations-driven political discussions in Geneva. The Americans are basically absent. You mentioned this conference in Brussels as well on refinancing. The Americans are simply absent. And people like the United Nations envoy, a very talented diplomat named Stefan de Mistura, keep saying publicly, where are the Americans? The Americans are absent. But I don't think the Trump administration wants to get involved, and they certainly don't want to spend any money on the Syrian civil war, much less on the reconstruction.
Frightening scenarios sketched for the future of Syria by Robert Ford, former U.S. ambassador to Syria and senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, also a professor at Yale. He spoke to us from New Haven, Connecticut. Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
2 years ago in the halls of the United Nations, then UN Ambassador Samantha Power personally viewed a horrifying exhibit of photographs of dead and obviously tortured Syrian detainees whose lives ended in the worst way and recorded in the most grisly attempt to bureaucratize torture, something that may be the legacy of the Assad regime.
It's hard to find words after walking through that exhibit. Repulsive, outrageous, enraging. I mean, what can one say? This regime has no shame.
These photographs, some of which show dead detainees in Syrian military hospitals, are evidence of a vast abuse of a population, perhaps without precedent in Middle East history. Louisa Lovelock, Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, says the story of systematic torture within the walls of military hospitals in Syria is a massive-scale atrocity. She's conducted dozens of interviews and has firsthand testimony of a man named Mohsen El-Masri, a detainee and survivor of torture inside a hospital known simply as Number 601.
We decided to look at what happens inside Syria's army hospitals. These are facilities which really sit at the heart of what has become an industrialized system of torture. And what we found was really quite chilling. They're the best example of the way that the state bureaucracy has been brought in to serve what is effectively the Syrian state's torture machine. Doctors have abused patients in their beds, they've withheld life-saving treatment, and other times they've joined in the beatings. And then the Syrian government, in its own paper trail, shows that these hospitals are places where dead detainees nationwide are brought to be catalogued, often in an incredibly methodical way, and then trucked away for mass burial.
Why the methodical documentation of this torture?
When you go to the Syrian government's own paper trail, you know, it shows that they were issuing orders which acknowledged the upsurge in deaths. You know, they acknowledged that there was such a spike in the number of dead bodies coming out of detention facilities, coming out of these interrogations, that there had to be a system, you know, a system which they say in the documentation was meant to offer judicial immunity for the state, that you had to take the bodies to these hospitals, you had to photograph them methodically, and you had to write a medical report. Unfortunately, every single medical report says that the patient's heart stopped or that they had a stroke.
And in terms of the documentation that you've been able to see, any estimate of how many of the tortures actually lead to fatalities of individuals who are, you know, part of this, oh gosh, their heart stopped and we couldn't interrogate them anymore kind of thing.
Unfortunately not. I think the most interesting thing about this documentation is that if you read between the lines, it is an acceptance of the surge in the death rate. The reason these hospitals are important from a legal point of view is because they're also still in service for the treatment of serving military personnel. That means they're places where leading figures in the army have strolled around, often past bankloads of fridges filled with dead bodies, you know, spillover fridges sometimes outside of the hospitals. And under international law, there is a principle of command responsibility. This effectively says that even if you're not directly responsible for these aggressions, people in positions of power are criminally liable for abuses that take place on the watch if they were in a position to stop them and did not. And at this stage, there is absolutely no plausible argument that many war crimes lawyers can see that they could not have been aware about the systematic and industrialized torture that was going on their watch.
So depending upon how this all ends up, there would be a mountain of evidence of prosecution for all levels of senior officials in the Bashar al-Assad government.
There are mountains of evidence in particularly in private law firms in Europe. The problem is that there is no mechanism by which to put them into practice. The International Criminal Court would be one of the most common ways of going after people who have perpetrated these injustices, but that route is completely closed off due to the sort of very complicated politics which govern the Syrian conflict. So at this stage, the only way that this evidence and these case files can be put into place is in private prosecutions, and we're starting to see the first of them in Spain and now in Germany. So it will be interesting to see in the coming months and years whether or not individual figures in the military or indeed, you know, doctors from these hospitals who are now in the refugee flow and have arrived in Europe, whether they can be prosecuted on European soil.
Is it possible to give a sense of, again, the scale and the brutality of this story simply through the narrative of what happened to Mohsen al-Masri?
He ended up in Hospital 601, and what he described to us was a hospital where sick prisoners are tortured, lying shackled to beds crammed with dying men. The men are all naked, they're blindfolded, and when people die, they can be left for a whole day among the living. When people finally are allowed to go to the bathrooms in Hospital 601, this facility, which is about a half mile from President Bashar al-Assad's palace, they would find bodies stacked on the floors, often bodies that they recognized. And another person we interviewed said that in his case, the bodies were stacked above his eye level.
I just can't even, I mean, where does this sit in the history of this terribly troubled place in the world?
The media narrative on Syria is very focused on ISIS. You know, we've all seen the pictures of the, you know, of Westerners in orange jumpsuits being murdered by ISIS militants. But when you spend time working on the horrors that take place in Syrian custody, it's difficult to find a parallel for that brutality. The only difference is that it is underground, it is hidden, and you don't see the fruits of it until an exhibition like the one you referenced, the exhibition of the UN, of these, you know, these skeletal corpses with drill marks and burns. Until you see them, you don't know what's going on. And I think the most chilling thing of all this is it's not something that's in the past. This abuse is ongoing as we speak, and I think that is the most troubling part of this.
Louisa Lovelock is a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, based in Beirut. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
To Capitol Hill now. We've all heard the threat from Senate Democrats to filibuster the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to be a Supreme Court justice. And we've heard that Republicans, in turn, are vowing to invoke what's called the nuclear option, essentially changing the filibuster rule possibly for all time, and meaning that the Democrats can't filibuster Gorsuch's nomination. But it's much bigger than Gorsuch. It's bigger even than the Supreme Court. It's all about the Senate rules, and those are a very, very big deal. Here to explain is Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
This is major history. And first of all, explain how the filibuster works and why it's so important to especially the older senators who are there.
Sure. And the filibuster is really important to the whole country. And it's times like this when they figure out why. If you feel like going into the standing rules of the Senate, dusting it off and cracking Rule 22, you'll see what I mean. Or I can just explain it. Look, it's pretty simple. To do most things in the Senate, you need 60 votes. That is usually used to mean you need some form of consensus in the Senate to get most big things done. It's not like the House where you just need a bare majority of one extra vote, right? That's how the Senate was designed. And that's the case on judicial nominees, most of them as well. Now, back in 2013, Democrats changed one part of the filibuster, and you don't need 60 votes anymore for most federal judgeships. The Supreme Court, John, was not involved in that. They left that out because Supreme Court justices are so important, such a big deal, appointed for life, and they still want to preserve the need for consensus on those. The nuclear option now would simply mean using 51 Republican votes to change the rules here, getting rid of the tradition of consensus on big legislation and big nominees and Supreme Court justices, and instead saying that Republicans can approve Neil Gorsuch here, get around a Democratic filibuster, and approve him with just 51 votes.
So let's underscore the original change in the rules about judicial nominees that weren't Supreme Court appointments was a kind of a Band-Aid. It was something to deal with a huge backlog and a gridlock in the Senate that was meant to be a temporary measure. This would be something much different.
This story really goes back to 2005, the first major confrontation between Republicans and Democrats over judicial nominations. George W. Bush was president, the Democrats were in the minority, and Bill Frist was majority leader, and there was blockades going on. The Bush administration wanted their nominees. There was a threat of a nuclear option then. A bunch of senators got together, banded together, and defused the crisis. Then you got to the fifth year of the Obama presidency, John, 2012 to 2013, when Republicans blockaded a record 79 Obama appointees to the federal court and wouldn't let anyone on the D.C. Court of Appeals. That's the level of the federal courts that really rules on a lot of regulations and federal laws, and a lot of stuff siphons through there to the Supreme Court. Well, Democrats said at that point a record 79 blockades for federal judgeships because it's Obama. That's when Harry Reid decided to invoke a mini nuclear option and change the rules for federal judges who aren't headed for the Supreme Court. So that was the latest chapter. Now, flash forward to this very political moment, I want to play you a little bit of tape to contextualize where we are now, because it's not just about judges, it's about partisanship, and it's about Donald Trump. Here's Mitch McConnell yesterday with his take on the politics of this whole thing.
Democrats are now being pushed by far-left interest groups into doing something truly detrimental to this body and to our country. They seem to be hurtling toward the abyss this time and trying to take the Senate with them. They need to reconsider.
That's Mitch McConnell talking about this political moment. Now, I only got to 2013 in my history, and I didn't mention a name that you're thinking of right now. That name is Judge Merrick Garland, nominated to the Supreme Court last year. Mitch McConnell didn't even give Merrick Garland a hearing, much less a vote. Here's the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
I have just two words for my Republican friends. Merrick Garland. The Republican majority conducted the first partisan filibuster of a Supreme Court pick when their members refused to have hearings for Merrick Garland. In fact, what the Republicans did was worse than a filibuster.
So there's kind of a fig leaf here that Merrick Garland came up during a presidential campaign, but there's been lots of arguments back and forth about whether you do that or don't do that. What Schumer and McConnell are both saying here is that this isn't about Neil Gorsuch. It's about, are we going to change the rules for all time? Is this fight worth this change? And does McConnell have the votes to change the rules?
That's the key question. Yesterday, for the first time, Mitch McConnell said he does have the votes to change the rules. That was not clear until that point, because there are traditionalist Republican senators who have not indicated that they would vote for the rule change, even if they support Neil Gorsuch. John, Republicans in the Senate are in a moment now, it is very clear, where in the past they may have backed off a nuclear confrontation, and senators would have gotten together behind the scenes, enough of them to circumvent the leadership. That's not happening now. There aren't a lot of footholds, John, between Donald Trump and his sort of anti-conservative populist presidency and conservative voters on the right. He promised over and over a conservative justice in the mold of Antonin Scalia. And it was one of the things, one of the few things that brought conservative voters into the Donald Trump camp. Republicans in the Senate now don't feel like they can risk not approving Neil Gorsuch under any circumstances, because their relationship, Donald Trump's relationship with the conservative right, would be severed. And that's a huge part of what's driving them now toward the nuclear option in the face of a Democratic filibuster.
But it's a heartbreaker for John McCain, who said yesterday it will harm the Senate forever. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
On our Facebook page, people are talking about how much the rules of the Senate are worth to them. Bridget writes, both parties should stop playing stop the other party and start learning how to meet in the middle. It's infuriating that we waited this long for a replacement for Scalia to allow the Republicans to have their way rather than compromise ages ago like they should have. Our elected officials are nothing but overgrown, spoiled children. But Kathy says, I think we should save our ammo for a bigger fight. The Dems just look like petulant children. Someone in Washington needs to be adult. I want to see a fully functioning government for a change. Join that conversation on our Facebook page or just find us on Twitter. If the big players at Fox News thought they could just quietly settle claims of sexual misconduct involving its famous on-air and off-air talent and move on, that's not the way it's turning out.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. Civil War in Congress. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. It is really all about hating Trump, not partisan politics.
Bill O'Reilly may want to talk politics on air, but a New York Times investigation this week that found O'Reilly made payouts to five women amounting to $13 million to settle claims of sexual harassment and other inappropriate behavior is hitting the network star and the network where it hurts. So far, more than 20 advertisers have said they're pulling their ads from the show. Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Allstate, T. Rowe Price, and Hyundai. There is an expectation that even more allegations will be made public. Takeaway producer Alex Botti spoke with Gabriel Sherman, national affairs editor for New York Magazine. First, it was Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, whose alleged behavior led to his firing. Now Sherman says, we will have to see how important this new O'Reilly factor will become.
Well, what this report illustrated is that over a period of years, Bill O'Reilly, the most popular and highest rated host on Fox News, used his position of power to dangle job opportunities and appearances on his show in exchange for what he hoped would lead to sexual relationships with women. These women alleged that he invited them to dinner, promised them career advancement, and then propositioned them for a sexual relationship. And the women who declined alleged that their careers suffered. And over the years, the New York Times reported that Bill O'Reilly paid out as much as $13 million in secret settlements to make these allegations go away.
Okay, and this is just sort of the latest in this saga for Bill O'Reilly, right?
Well, both for Bill O'Reilly and Fox News. I mean, this latest scandal comes in a much broader context about a network that is reeling from a whole slate of sexual harassment allegations. We should remember last summer, Roger Ailes, the powerful chairman and CEO of Fox News, who created the network in 1996, was forced out of his job after more than two dozen women came forward to allege that he sexually harassed them through the years. So this is a problem that seems to be endemic to the culture of Fox News.
What else can you sort of tell us about that culture now, with these allegations coming, as you say, on the heels of similar allegations against Roger Ailes? What's the culture like now at Fox? What do we know about that? Is it really worse than other work environments?
Yes, without question. You know, in the wake of Ailes' ouster, Rupert Murdoch and his sons, James and Lachlan Murdoch, promised that the culture at Fox News would change and that women would feel like they were working in a safe environment. And they made merely cosmetic changes But unfortunately, the culture, the male-dominated misogynist culture, persists at Fox News. And notably, the senior executives who worked alongside Roger Ailes, who in many cases enabled and helped to cover up sexual harassment, were not removed from their positions. And so the people who were at Fox News on the watch when women were being harassed by men at Fox News are still there. So people I talk to inside the network sadly tell me really not much has changed. And that is why we see ongoing lawsuits, because women and employees who work there feel like they have no recourse other than to seek justice in the legal system.
Now we have this growing pressure on Fox to deal with this. We've got a number of advertisers pulling out. Tell us who these companies are. Why are they now backing away from O'Reilly?
Yeah, some of the most blue chip and prestigious brands who advertise on Fox News, like Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and others, have pulled their ads from Bill O'Reilly's show. Now, we should point out that in some cases, these are cosmetic protests because they're not pulling their advertising from Fox News writ large. They're just merely moving the inventory that they've bought on the network to other parts of the schedule. So from a business perspective, the company is not seeing a hit to their revenues right now. Now, if this problem snowballs, we could see, you know, advertisers just decide to pull out entirely. But this is really a public relations crisis at this point, not a fundamental business one.
So then the question becomes, as advertisers are withdrawing these ads, I mean, could we see repercussions for O'Reilly himself?
You know, I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen with Bill O'Reilly. I think the company's position, from people I talk to at the highest levels, is a wait and see. They're in bunker mode. They're trying to ride this out. If more women come forward and the scandal snowballs, yes, I think they could be pressure on him to step down. But I think what we're going to see is that the only way that Fox News is going to change is if Rupert Murdoch decides to fundamentally clean house, sort of remove this entire senior leadership structure at Fox that was there during the Ailes era and bring in fresh management. But Rupert Murdoch historically has been very loath to bend to public pressure. His instinct is to double down. He's done it time and again. If you look at the London phone hacking scandal, he, you know, protected Rebecca Brooks, who is at the center. And so, you know, right now, I think we're in a little bit of a cold war, a standoff, where you have the public outrage and a lot of the activist groups calling for change at Fox News. And you have Rupert Murdoch, the media mogul atop the network, really resisting.
Gabe, do you think viewers of Fox really care about this, that O'Reilly has been accused now again and again of being a sexual predator?
I think the short answer is no. And unfortunately, I think the viewers who watch Fox News watch it because it fits their worldview and it represents them. You know, historically, when Bill O'Reilly was engulfed in previous scandals, and including a sexual harassment scandal, we should remember back in 2004, one of his producers, Andrea Macris, accused him of sexually harassing her. Bill O'Reilly's ratings actually went up in the wake of that scandal. So his audience is very loyal. And again, that is one of the things that is protecting him, is the fact that in the past he has weathered these storms.
All right, Gabe, put your money on the table here. Will Bill O'Reilly be on the air this time next year?
Oh, gosh. I'm not a betting man. So one of the reasons I don't bet is I don't like to bet on things I can't control. It really depends. If this thing snowballs and more women come forward, no, I don't think he would be on the air this time next year.
Gabe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Takeaway producer Alex Botti speaking with national affairs editor for New York Magazine and author of The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. One more detail on this story. This week, former Fox News contributor Julie Roginski filed a lawsuit against the network's former CEO Roger Ailes and current co-president Bill Shine. Roginski claims that she was denied the chance of securing a permanent role at Fox after turning down Ailes' sexual advances. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The symphony conductor, with must gray hair, wildly waving hands and baton to get the orchestra to reach the music's highs and lows. Now listen to this genteel rendition of the operetta Die Fledermaus, performed by the Nottingham Symphony Orchestra in Great Britain. And holding the baton is a little fellow, straight out of Harry Potter. 11 years old, Matthew Smith has a few other special powers besides his conductor's baton.
Violin, a bit of viola, drums, piano, and guitar.
Derek Williams is Matthew's teacher, and normally conducts the Nottingham Symphony Orchestra, or NSO. Matthew considers classical music his world right now. He's a fifth grader, having the time of his life.
You can find lots of different ways of playing in there. There's loud, there's quiet, and most of the time, the music has a story behind it. Like the Hall of the Mountain King. That musical song is about a prince, I think, who goes up to a tower to save a princess.
Is that the one that goes... Bum 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 bum. Is that Hall of the Mountain King?
Yes.
Any pieces you'd like to tackle?
Beethoven's Last Symphony. This was the first song I performed at my school. It was Beethoven's Last Symphony as well.
So Ode to Joy was really something that connected with you.
I mean, in the early years, when he played that on the violin to the school, after only about 5 or 6 weeks of playing the violin, the teachers were in tears and the kids were open-mouthed. He then sat down at the piano and played the same tune on the piano, but in different keys. And then the following week, he put in a bass line, and I said, "Well, Matthew, where did you learn to do that?" And he said, "Oh, somebody at church showed you, is that right?" "That's right." And so the Ode to Joy was his tune, really.
Tell me a little bit about this transition to conducting, Matthew.
So I never really knew what conducting was until about 2 to 3 years ago. Derek, he told me that he would like me to learn the song called The Fledermaus, and he said he'll give me a lesson on it. In about a week, I learnt the song off by heart. So at that time, he went to the NSO and he said that I have a 9-year-old boy who's going to conduct you. But according to Derek, they said that he's too young. I'm a bit mature now, I'm a bit older, so I've only been doing it for 2 months. And since I'm a lot smaller than them, I do have to put my hands up, make sure they can see me, make sure I'm seen by the whole orchestra. What can be hard most of the time.
Are you worried about the criticism, Derek, that this could be viewed as a stunt?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? We didn't start off like that. I mean, it's just the sort of the media has grabbed this, you know, him being the youngest conductor in the world and all that stuff, which is a load of rubbish, really, because he saw the film of a 7-year-old conducting in Uzbekistan.
Do you think classical music will be something that you're interested in as a teenager and as an even older person beyond 11 years there, Matthew?
I will keep on doing my classical music, and I will keep on conducting an orchestra, and I will keep on playing my violin. I might join a quartet, and I might keep on playing some tunes as well.
Matthew, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Young conductor Matthew Smith and his teacher Derek Williams. This music was the actual piece conducted by Matthew, by the way, and you can find a link to the performance on our website, thetakeaway.org. Busy week on the road from St. Louis to back home here in New York City to Boston, where we'll be hosting the show from our partner WGBH's studio at the Boston Public Library. Yes, that was what we're going to be doing on Friday. It's the show's first visit to Boston since the election. And in our travels since last November, we found a number of local communities busy problem-solving on their own, in their own local communities. There was a kitchen table discussion in Oklahoma, outreach for veterans post-war, two worried communities in St. Louis worried about some toxic landfills. Our next guest believes that good design is a great way to spur local problem-solving, and she says public libraries, like the one in Boston we will be visiting on Friday, have become multifaceted community centers. Sarah Williams-Goldhagen is an architecture critic and the author of Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives.
The contemporary library has become sort of a stand-in for a community center where you have not only books and access to all sorts of media, but you have knitting classes and mothers with children and community meetings and so on. So it's a complex design problem, because how do you make a space that actually works within that thing? Now, a lot of people just build sort of sheds, but that's not enough, because the more and more we know about design, the more we know that if a design is not helping people, it's actually diminishing their experience or even hurting them. And one of the interesting design problems about a community library in particular is that libraries have become really one of the principal social condensers of contemporary society, particularly in the United States, which is such a heterogeneous society and has so many different interest groups serving these small little local buildings.
And a built environment that says welcome.
Certainly. A very good example is David Ajay's library in Washington, D.C., called the Francis Gregory Library. It's in an underprivileged neighborhood in South Washington. What did he do? It's a shed, because how else are you going to accommodate so many different functions? But he made the exterior of the facade highly mirrored, because there's a park surrounding the building. Now, it's not a very nice park, but the building, through the reflections of the green and the light that change all day long, actually make that whole place a nicer park. And
it integrates the outside environment with the inside.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's been so much talk about the tension between immigrants and the authorities, the people who want to deport them. And yet, there are all these needs and all these stories of how immigrant communities have driven the use of public libraries. Can design actually address some of the issues of assimilation, language development, education, civic responsibility that would make our immigrant problems less?
Absolutely, because good design helps people feel well, keeps them coming back. These little libraries are social condensers. So because they're free and available to everybody around, everybody can come in and use them. There's a library that just was finished in Elmhurst, Queens, in which they have public art that's specifically connected to the immigrant community there. It's a very heavily Asian immigrant community. And everything matters in terms of design, the way that you display the different language newspapers and create a common meeting place where people can read. Some people can read in Hindi, some people can read in Mandarin, and so on and so forth. The organization of the internal spaces has a lot to do with whether people communicate with one another or go off into their little corners. So design absolutely can help sort of create a sense of common identity, which is, of course, what this country is about.
Yeah, it's very American-sounding.
Yes, in a way that very few other spaces really can.
A library card, a first step to civic identity in
Absolutely.
America. I love that.
Absolutely.
Sarah Williams-Goldhagen is an architecture critic and author of Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In early April of 1994, the Hutu majority government of Rwanda embarked on a campaign of slaughter against the minority ethnic group, the Tutsi, killing more than 800,000 people, raping up to 250,000 women over the course of 100 days. In a nation of fear and hatred, would anyone ever face their abuser and seek justice? This woman, who goes by the name JJ, spoke through a translator about her experience at the United Nations in October of last year.
To talk about what happened to me and to my friend, it took a very long time for me to get out of fear to start speaking out. But I decided to put it in light. And I wanted the justice, I wanted the judge, the lawyers, and everyone to know exactly the truth. But Prosper was right behind me, and he really pushed me as someone that was weak, and he kept encouraging me. He said, don't be shy, don't be scared.
The name she says there, Pierre Prosper, remember it. He's a young lawyer who started out as a deputy district attorney doing gang work in Los Angeles. But no one had ever prosecuted a genocide case in an international court before, nor had rape ever been prosecuted as a war crime. Pierre took the case, a prosecution like no other. The story of this Rwanda rape trial is told in The Uncondemned, a documentary film by writer and director Michelle Mitchell. Michelle and Pierre told me, besides making sure that the horrors of Rwanda are not forgotten, this trial has created tools for fighting rape as a weapon of war for the very first time, a weapon still being used around the world today.
Coming into a situation like Rwanda is, at that time, was completely, you know, unprecedented, you know, not only as a human being, but also as a lawyer. And, you know, when you start seeing the trauma, the magnitude of the abuses that the victims and the survivors went through, it by itself ignites a passion because they're looking for someone to bring justice. And we have to remember, at that time, the United Nations had failed Rwanda by leaving the country. The peacekeepers departed and allowed the genocide to take place. So when you come in, everyone's looking at you to say, are you the one? Are you going to make a difference? And then once you realize that you have to shoulder that responsibility, it actually gave me the energy to move forward and try to, you know, achieve justice.
Michelle, in doing this film, when did you have a sense during the process that, in fact, this was the first real treatment of rape as a war crime officially in a courtroom? That's big.
It is big. All the cases I heard about were from the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia at The Hague. That's the first time we actually really have a concerted effort to cover sexual violence and conflict. So it was only a chance meeting with a human rights lawyer who said, what are you going to do next? I said, I'm going to do a film about the first time rape was prosecuted as a crime of war. And she said, Akayesu. I was like, what? Aka what? And it was this case that if you're a law student, you may have heard of. And then she said, you need to talk to Pierre Prosper.
And tell me about the defendant here.
His name is Jean-Paul Akayesu. Akayesu was the mayor of the town of Taban. Eloquent guy, good-looking man, and really well-liked by the population. So it was surprising that he made the flip and became this evil person that instilled this violence and atrocity.
The thing that struck me and left me very just feeling cold to my bones is that this is actually how genocide happens. It's the guy who's not at the top. It's the person in the middle who decides that it's in his own self-interest to participate or not to stop something. And that's how horrible, heinous things happen.
Did people want to testify?
Well, that was one of the most difficult aspects, was persuading the witnesses to come forward for multiple reasons. One, to get them to even trust us, to trust the United Nations, was a difficult task. So we spent a lot of time trying to build confidence. Secondly, there was a real issue of witness intimidation and people being killed. If you recall, at the time, it was right when there was still the fighting in the former Zaire, and it ultimately became the Congo. So we were experiencing violence on a daily occurrence within Rwanda. And then again, the third part is reliving the horror. And in this process, you know, each witness would be on the stand from, you know, maybe 4 hours to a full day. And even at a certain point in time during the trial, Akayesu had the opportunity to ask them questions. So it was, once the community started to hear about that, it was difficult to encourage people. But at the same time, the witnesses who went through the process found it cathartic.
What effect did it have on you to witness and really read all of the documentation that was just text, which is horrific enough, and then the people that you spoke with?
It was something I was not prepared for. I don't think there's a course in vicarious trauma that we're taught in journalism school. And I was asked at a hospital in Congo by these women who had been repeatedly attacked by a militia. They said, does the world really want to hear our story? And I remember saying to them, no, but I promise you I'm going to find a way to tell this story so that the world wants to hear it. And I think about those women every day.
What I saw when you begin the conversation with a victim of sexual violence is the depth of the destruction. It's something that stays with the victim in perpetuity.
People speak of dying of sadness as a result of this.
Exactly, dying of sadness. And it also impacts their family and the community. So you realize that it's a total, it destroys the fabric. And then once you realize that, then it not only does it shock the conscious, but you realize that this is something that must be stopped.
Because of this film, no one can ever say from now on what about sexual violence.
You can never say that there's nothing you can do, that it's something that just happens, because there is something. And that word accountability that Pierre said is so important, not just to survivors, but for all of us. You know, if we are serious about being a civil society and about evolving, and we've accomplished so many things when it comes to art, culture, science, technology, but the fact that this still exists on the mass level that it does, well, that's a step backward. And if we're going to survive as humanity, then we need to address this and address it for real.
Michelle and Pierre, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pierre Prosper is lead attorney on the Rwandan genocide rape case and the first lawyer to try rape as a war crime. Michelle Mitchell is the director, writer, and producer of The Uncondemned. A reminder, the United States chose not to intervene in Rwanda and has largely held the same policy in Syria's civil war. Yesterday, a chemical attack allegedly carried out by the Syrian government killed dozens of women, children, and elderly people. Whose responsibility is it to push back and hold dictators accountable?
We should have been more involved years ago in Syria, especially with the war crimes going on, and we should have worked harder to push Russia to fight against them, even if it was only through sanctions. And I'm not really sure how we can do that now, what with the Trump administration having such admiration for those abetting war crimes.
Peter Dumont, Berkeley, California. This is a job for the United Nations Security Council. No one nation should be expected or required to respond alone. It is an unfortunate golden opportunity for a united response on the part of the international community so that, echoing Lincoln, these lives may not have been lost in vain.
We'd love to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.